Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, is it harder for students to get into UMass Amherst if they're from Massachusetts? A new report says it is, and a state senator is concerned.
As it is, we have limited resources, and those resources should be focused on our students.
Also today, Harvard researchers offer some policy advice after taking an in-depth look at what happens to people in the first year after they're released from prison in Massachusetts.
Average income over the course of the study was under $1,000 a month. So people were exiting prison for poverty.
Plus, music that symbolized women's rage 20 years ago and why Alanis Morissette's songs are resonating in a new ART musical.
Somehow Alanis's music, which was so powerful then, feels necessary in a way that is really uncanny for our times.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. It appears that it may be more difficult for Massachusetts students to get admitted to UMass Amherst than it is for students who live in other states. A new study from the Pioneer Institute finds that since 2010, grade point averages and SAT scores for out-of-state accepted students are lower than those for accepted students from Massachusetts. One reason might be financial, because out-of-state students pay higher tuition and fees than in-state students. But in some other states, officials have capped the number of out-of-staters allowed in their public university systems. So listeners, before we get to the conversation, we also want to hear from you, and we want you to join in the conversation. What do you think? Should the state's flagship public university be easier to get accepted to for in-state students, or is this a good way for cash-strapped public education systems to fill the gaps? Do you think the state should cap the number of non-resident students allowed? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. But with us in the studio right now is the lead author of that report, Mary Connaughton, the Pioneer Institute's Director of Government Transparency and Director of Finance and Administration. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Also on the line with us from Seattle is Marguerite Rosa, a research professor at Georgetown University and director of Georgetown's Economics Lab, where she focuses on education finance. Marguerite, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me. And I should clarify that it's the Edunomics Lab.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Mary, let's start with you. Tell us more about what you found, the difference between GPAs and SAT scores between in-state and out-of-state students at UMass Amherst.
Right. We did a public records request of UMass and of the Department of Higher Education. We were really curious as to what the answer would be if there were different standards for in-state versus out-of-state students. And we first got the response to our request from the Department of Higher Education. And when we looked at it, we were pretty surprised to see that there was a difference across the board for the since 2010, which is the date that we asked for. We're not sure what it was before that. Mm-hmm. We can see across the board, GPAs were higher for in-state students, as were the combined SAT scores. In 2016, the combined SAT score for in-state student was 23 points higher, and the average GPA for in-state student being accepted was 3.97 versus 3.79 for out-of-state students. Still very high, very competitive, but who wouldn't want to get into the wonderful school of UMass Amherst?
Right, but not a huge difference.
Not a huge difference, but it's an average, and it's a very consistent difference.
Mm. So why don't you tell us first, one of the reasons, of course, this might be happening is because out-of-state students pay more. How much more?
The right now, going to UMass Amherst, it's close to $30,000 all in. It's about $48,000 for an out-of-state student, and most of that is tuition and fees. It's higher for an out-of-state, more costly for an out-of-state student to come in. when you start adding up the $15,000, $16,000 differential, that's pretty attractive for the school to get that money in the doors.
I should say we did reach out to UMass Amherst for a statement or to be on the program today to talk about this. And as of airtime, they did not get back to us. But historically, what has UMass said about out-of-state students coming in, why this might be happening, and what's going on here?
Well, the belief is that it's great to have geographic diversity for the school, so all students learn from different parts, from people from different parts of the country. But it was also, the premise was that the academic rigor of the school would be increased by having out-of-state students, with the thought being that their academic achievement before coming into the college was higher. To actually raise the stakes. I mean, the University of Massachusetts has been going through the roof in terms of its national rankings, and but are the out-of-staters contributing that much to it? Now, I would say, obviously, there's many out-of-state students that come in with higher GPAs, but we're just looking at the average here.
And so I think your study said that about 26% of UMass Amherst students were non-resident students. So how does that affect, for the fall of 2016?
Right.
So how does that affect campus, do you think? And what is it doing in terms of events at UMass Amherst in the public system?
Well, the question is, what do those students do after they leave UMass? Do they stay? Do they build the bonds with the students there and want to stay in the state and work here and raise a family here, become part of the community, be part of the economic boom of Massachusetts? Or do they just come here and then take their wonderful education to another state? What does Massachusetts get out of that?
Mm-hmm.
In Massachusetts right now for 2017, the appropriation from the state for UMass-wide, not just Amherst, was $720 million. So the state taxpayers are footing part of that bill.
But couldn't you also say that out-of-state students paying higher tuition is helping subsidize it for in-state students paying lower tuition?
Yes, absolutely. But that's the question. Are there other ways to subsidize in-state students? Could administrative costs be lower? If you're a parent and your child who's worked hard, got a really good grade point average, did well on the SATs, and their goal is to get to UMass because they're going to get a great education at a relatively low cost compared to a private school education of $70,000 now they're looking at. Is that the right way to be looking at it? Should those kids have the edge? If everything else is equal, should the in-state kids get the advantage of going to UMass? And is there a better way to fund it?
All right. Marguerite, I just want to bring you in here. How does this compare with what's happening in other states?
So I think the pattern or the challenge that's on the table here is very common with other state public universities, and that is that the university will receive some of its money from the state legislature, and that money has not as grown as fast as tuition or as costs have grown at the public university. And so the universities are acting sort of in their best economic interest to try to find more revenue somewhere else, and tend to try to augment their out-of-state students because they come with a larger amount of cash. So that pattern has happened in lots of different places, and that tension has come up in lots of different places because the residents of the state will say, you know, this university is something that I've paid in through my state. It's a state resource. It's here for to augment the education of the students who live in the state and ultimately contribute to the economy of the state. And if you are catering to too many students from out of state or potentially making it easier to get in from out of state, then, you know, you're not serving that public purpose. But the numbers do vary from different places. And there are still plenty of them where, you know, the students that are coming from out of state might actually be augmenting the student profile.
Right.
Actually, I'm not sure that this analysis clarifies that, because if you look at accepted students on the average, what you don't know is sort of what's happening on that margin for the last few students who are getting in. And oftentimes, in-state students will apply to their public university, especially the strongest students, and they might apply to other ones. So it may be the case that of the students who actually come, who are at the top of the sort of test score spread and things like that. They're not that many from the in-state. So the average of who's accepted may not be the average of who's coming. And so it's, you know, the numbers, there are two different pools, and we did a similar study a few years ago, and we really looked at the kids on the margin, like the ones that had just barely gotten in from in-state and the ones who had just barely gotten in from out-of-state, and compared those two to get a sense of whether or not it's actually easier to get in.
Mm-hmm. Mary, I want you to jump in. I just want Mary to clarify here.
We looked at both enrolled and unenrolled students, and in the same averages, I mean, it was lower for unenrolled, for actually enrolled than unenrolled on the whole, but the same pattern held true in that for the enrolled students, they had higher GPAs and higher SAT scores than for in-state than out-of-state.
Okay.
Got it.
I just want to make sure we get some callers' voices in here as well. Nicolette is calling from Worcester. Nicolette, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. How are you?
Okay, how are you?
I just want to say, good. As a parent looking at colleges in the year and as an alumni of UMass, I had a general understanding that UMass has done wonderfully over the last 20 years in terms of rankings, but I find it extremely unsettling now having a college-age child that in-state is far more difficult as compared to out-of-state. And that was my just initial reaction. It's been interesting listening to the conversation. I know there's a lot of other factors to consider, but I do feel like that's unfortunate. I think looking at colleges, we assume as parents that you know, it's an equal, fair sort of acceptance based on scores and what you've done over the 4 years. And to hear that you might be at a little bit of a disadvantage just living in your own state is a little bit unsettling. I hope that changes happen, you know, after looking at these studies.
But Nicolette, I'm wondering, you know, what do you say to folks who say, you know what, bringing in more out-of-state students at a higher rate helps keep the system strong?
Right, I understand. And so I think it was just new information, you know, weighing that out when applying for colleges and understanding that it's important to know.
Okay.
So it's good information.
All right. Listeners, just a reminder, we want to hear from you, too. What do you think? Should the state's flagship public university be easier to get into for in-state students or out-of-state students? Is this a way for cash-strapped public education systems to fill the gaps? Call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Marguerite Rosa, I just want to ask you, could some of what we're seeing here be because the entire system of getting into college is so much more competitive now?
Well, I'm not sure that that's it. I think that universities are just responding to their own cost pressures. And they're just, this got teed up a little bit earlier, but there are other ways they could respond. And potentially for you know, if you're a family that is right on the margin, you live in the state and you don't get into the university, you know, the argument that, well, this keeps the university strong if we take more out-of-state students, you know, if you didn't have access to it, that's
right.
Sort of moot for you.
Right.
So if you think, well, what other ways can we keep the university strong, both financially and academically? And there are other possible ways and that this can happen. So if the university needs more money, you know, saying, well, I can take a lower a lower scoring student out of state at a higher dollar amount, there might be some lower scoring students in state who might say, well, I pay the higher dollar amount. And
so,
maybe there's
yeah.
a way to have a tiered tuition model inside the state that charged potentially higher tuition for students with greater means. And then you can, the state could get some money and still be loyal and keeping those spots for its in-state mm-hmm. students. So there are other opportunities on the table, but this is one that we're seeing happen, this sort of steer toward more out-of-state students is happening across the country and creating these tensions between public universities right. and their communities.
Right, California. Tell us briefly about the system there. I mean, they ended up putting a cap, right, on the number of out-of-staters allowed?
Yes, and this has been kind of a negotiation that universities have with their legislatures, and other places have done the same thing. Washington State did it as well, where what happens is that in a particular year, the university might try to solve its financial problems by taking more out-of-state students, bringing in that extra revenue, meaning there are fewer spots for the in-state students. And then the legislature hears about it and says, hey, you know, we want the university to still be here on behalf of our state students. And then there's this kind of tension where the university says, yeah, but you didn't give us enough money. And the legislature sometimes says, well, we'll give you a little bit more money, but we want to make sure in return that you make the universities available for more in-state students. And some universities have responded by saying, okay, I'll do that, and I'll still take more out-of-state students, meaning we just sort of grew the enrollment. And those are other strategies to sort of solve the financial problems anyway. But I think what's happening is that universities are acting, you know, according to where the financial incentives are.
Hmm. Is anybody doing that tiered tuition model right now? If you earn more, you should pay more?
Yeah, I'm not sure, but I know it's come up in quite a few places, and some are saying, well, we'll raise the tuition, but we'll maybe give more financial aid. That's another way to sort of do a tiered tuition. Mm-hmm. But this university's expenses have risen faster than state budgets have risen. And so they find themselves in this conundrum where, you know, the state might give them a little bit more money, but it doesn't cover the growth in costs at the universities. And there are, you know, lots of opportunities here to think about this financial puzzle. And one that was just raised a little earlier was what the university might think about cutting its costs or spending less money, think about getting revenue in different areas, think mm-hmm. about growing its enrollment. Those are sort of all on the table, I think. But we are seeing universities go for the out-of-state student extra cash.
Right. I want to take some calls. Kara, as our lines are full, Carolina is calling from Worcester. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to share my experience. As a high school senior, I had a 3.8 GPA. I applied to, like, at least 10 different schools. And when it came to the state schools, I got waitlisted. And that was a huge impact on my life because coming from a low-income family, having to choose a private school over a state school, it has an impact down the road, especially with I had specifically received a scholarship that would have given me free tuition, and I had to give that up because I was waitlisted.
When was this, Carolina? When did you apply?
So I applied 4 years ago.
To UMass. UMass Amherst. Yep. And you had a 3.8 GPA.
Right, and I had above average SAT scores, MCAS scores. I'm still a great student all around the board.
Where did you end up going?
I went to Nichols College, which is a small business school in
Dudley, mm-hmm.
Southern Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
Yep,
good. And you made it. You made it okay, but you would have liked the opportunities to go to UMass Amherst, but they were not available
right.
to you.
I was looking forward to going to Eisenberg because I'm an accounting major, but unfortunately, I guess they had to look out for their pockets instead of mine.
Oof. Okay. Carolina, thanks so much for the call. I also want to go to Campbell, who's calling from Dover. Campbell, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. My son is 27 years old. He graduated from UMass, which is from Mass Art, which is a university system school.
Mm-hmm.
What I haven't heard you mention is what percentage of the total state university system budget is funded by taxes in the Commonwealth. It would seem to me most logical to tie a percentage, a minimum percentage, of in-state students to a percentage of the budget that's covered by taxes.
Okay, good question. Mary, Marguerite, Marguerite, you've looked at strategies. Has that ever been a potential strategy before to look at percentage and decide whether that's the amount that should be allowed here?
Yes, and that's great, except then the state doesn't have enough money 1 year, and so they're funding Medicaid or K-12 education, two other very large things in state budgets, and higher ed is often sort of lower on the list, and then they can't meet those targets. So that's very much, you know, it sounds great to say we should have this number, and then I think the legislators have sort of striven for that and then not been able to meet the number. So then they say we'll give you a little bit less this year. This very much happens. And I think part of what you'll have at least some residents will find frustrating is that, you know, they grew up in Massachusetts, lived in Massachusetts, and maybe right before they went to college could have moved across the state line and then gotten into their college, but not gotten in if stayed in the state. And then that kind of calls the question, this whole sense of what is a public university and who is it for and what are our goals as part of that.
Mm-hmm. Mary, I'm just wondering, we heard Carolina who called in, 3.8 GPA, mm-hmm. above average SATs, 4 years ago got waitlisted at UMass, ended up going to a private college mm-hmm. instead, which presumably was more affordable. I know in the report you mentioned the disparate allocation of scholarships. It isn't something that you looked at in this report, right. but you mentioned it. Can you explain that?
Right. We'd like to see another project we'd like to look at is scholarships and financial aid down the road to find out how the financial aid formula really works for in-state students and try to look at tuition net of financial aid to find out what people are actually paying. That would be another study that we'd like to do.
Okay. I want to go to more callers. Line's still full. Jim is calling from Newton. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to bring up the point that I was a kid from Minnesota who applied to a college here in Massachusetts, and I got in with lower scores than the average there, but I always chalked it up that they were looking for diversity in these prestigious schools. Hmm. And so I know when my daughter was looking for colleges, we were there at a pre-admissions thing, and some kid was in the audience from South Dakota. And they chased that kid down because they wanted to tick the box and get, you know, a person from every state. So I don't know whether or not their motivations are tuition-based or diversity-based in order to keep prestigious school.
Okay, good question. Mary Connaughton, you know, how much of this really can you say for certain is because of higher tuition, or are schools trying, particularly UMass Amherst, trying to attract a more diverse student body that could be more cosmopolitan and help everybody in the long run? Is that part of the argument?
I would say that's certainly a part of the argument. Mm-hmm. It's hard to say how much of the argument that is. We know how important it is to fund the school and how important money is, but geographic diversity is a very much wanted for all colleges across the country. They want to make sure that they're represented by each state. But if you have 50 states, you can get represented. But when you're admitting all these thousands of kids, you know, is that the ultimate goal, or is it really to get that extra tuition?
Right. Marguerite, what do you say about that, about how do we know that it's for extra tuition and maybe it's for geographic diversity reasons?
Well, we did a similar study to this one a few years back on another university and called the admissions department at the university, let them know the study was coming out, and they would likely get calls. And they said, well, can you delay the release of the study because our director of admissions is overseas recruiting right now, which was very ironic at the time. But we looked at there's quite a few international students, but they all, for the most part, came from two countries. So sometimes, you know, this claim is really about diversity, but it's not really diversifying after a certain number. You know, there may be this, you know, kind of draw, it's nice to have kids from all the different states, but there are probably also a range of socioeconomic mix and race and rural and urban, even in the state of Massachusetts. And so that's a balance to be done. But it's, you know, universities have not hidden the reality that they're doing part of the international and out-of-state students is part of plugging their budgets. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it becomes a little bit of a pay-to-play feature here where, you know, if you have the money to pay an out-of-state tuition, you can get in, and if you're in-state, you're not actually even given that option. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't even pay extra to get in. You just don't have access.
I see. I just want to take one more call. We're almost out of time. Madison is calling from Cohasset. Madison, you're on the air.
Hi. I want to keep it brief, but I just wanted to say that I'm from Massachusetts, and I actually applied to colleges 2 years ago. I'm a college student right now. And as a lower-income student, I loved the fact that UMass was more competitive, and I loved the fact that it was drawing in the best students from Massachusetts, because I felt like this was not only a good option, but this was also going to be an option for me that was attracting the best students from the state. And I was totally okay knowing that it was more competitive for me as an in-state student.
Okay, good point there. Maybe this helps make, you know, in-state schools or public university systems more competitive. And so it helps everyone. There's another argument. Mary?
Well, all things being equal, same SAT scores, and it's hard to weigh what the other extracurriculars how far they come into the equation here. But all things being equal, if it's a state university, I would hope that they would admit the state kid, the kid, the resident, before an out-of-state kid, because it's their home. It's where they kind of count on going, and not to admit them over with because an out-of-state kid got it. It just seems like, you know, if you're a parent, it's heartbreaking. You're a kid, it's heartbreaking.
Right, right. And Marguerite, any strategies that we didn't talk about? I know we talked about the tiered tuition model and other ways to sort of help public universities get the money they need without having to have more out-of-state students coming in. What is there another strategy that you think might be a good option for schools like UMass Amherst?
Well, I think that many of these schools, you know, as I mentioned, have seen some quite a bit of cost growth. And you know, the other place to keep an eye on this is to say, like, are there options to contain cost growth within the university so that we can lean on more students from in-state? And along those lines, you know, are there certain kinds of programs and things like that we want to reserve more spots for the students who are in-state? The other piece is to grow the enrollment generally. So I know a lot of universities say, you know, we're full, but you know, with new technologies and new ways to deliver instruction, maybe it is the case that we can actually increase the school by 10% more in-state students, get those students to get their spots, and grow the enrollment and still become financially sustainable.
Okay, Marguerite Rosa, research professor at Georgetown University and director of Georgetown's Edunomics Lab. Marguerite, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Mary Connaughton, the Pioneer Institute's Director of Government Transparency and Director of Finance and Administration. You can find a link to the Pioneer Institute report at our website, radioboston.org. Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. While mass incarceration and the skyrocketing increase in the number of people behind bars have been well documented, what's not very well known is what happens once people are released from prison. Our next guest closely followed more than 100 people in the year after they were released from prison in Massachusetts, and he says his research raises some profound questions about prisons, punishment, and society's obligations to those who've been incarcerated. Bruce Western is a criminal justice and sociology professor at Harvard University, and he's co-director of the Columbia Justice Lab. His new book, Homeward, Life in the Year After Prison, is based on a study that he led that followed 122 people in the Boston area as they navigated their first year out. And he joins us from New York. Bruce, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Now, you followed more than 100 people, as we said, in your study. And I want to let listeners know that we will hear some excerpts of interviews that you did with people in their first year out of prison. But what, essentially, were you hoping to learn in your Boston reentry study?
Yeah, we were trying to find out how people made ends meet after they were released from prison, how they reconnected with family, how they found jobs, how their health was going. And when they did go back to prison, what was going on that led them back into incarceration? And so we were trying to learn about a whole variety of different topics that were as much connected to poverty, I think, in America as much to criminal justice.
So when you say led them back into incarceration, a lot of times when we talk about reentry, as it's called, there's a lot of numbers about recidivism. What did you learn about folks who were likely to reoffend that first year out and what kind of policies might help them not to reoffend?
Yeah. So recidivism in many ways is, you know, the whole focus of so much of criminal justice policy and prison policy in particular. And I think one of the things that we found out is that when people find themselves returning to custody, a lot of different things are going on. Sometimes they're returning to crime and getting back involved in crime. So a lot of times they're relapsing to addiction, and relapse to addiction was the biggest cause of the return to custody. And the pathway from relapse back into prison could take a lot of different forms. Sometimes people are on binges and getting involved in crimes, doing robberies to help support their addiction. Sometimes they were failing drug tests, and sometimes they were just causing conflict, becoming antisocial. They weren't getting involved in serious crime again, but they were getting rearrested. And often if they were under parole or probation supervision, they'd be locked up again. So recidivism is a lot of different things. It's not just a return to criminal behavior.
I see. You know, you said something in the book that really stood out to me. You wrote, quote, human frailty reveals that our prisons are not just crime control institutions, but social policy instruments of last resort. Can you explain that?
Yeah, yeah. So we saw, as we got to know the people we were interviewing, and we're talking to people many times over the course of a year. And one of the really striking things is that a lot of people we were interviewing were really struggling with mental illness and physical illness. And the physical illnesses they were dealing with were things like chronic disease, infectious diseases, chronic pain, often related to drug use. Mental illnesses they were struggling with were mood disorders like depression, and a handful of people in our sample had serious mental illness like bipolar disorder or schizophrenia. And often these things were co-occurring, and so people who struggled with chronic pain also had chronic diseases of other kinds, also struggling with mental health problems. And so they were physically and mentally vulnerable in many ways, and this was a large part of why they were coming into conflict with the law, why they were getting arrested, and why they were finding their way into prison. And so the prison then, in this case, I think is responding not just to serious crime. It's not just punishing serious crime, but it's responding to a whole sequence of failures of our social institutions to keep people safe and healthy. Right. And I think when people are going to prison because they're mentally ill, they're struggling with disability and so on, our institutions, our penal institutions are being called on to do something quite different from punishment.
Right, right. You know, you talk about your interviews with a lot of the folks and how they describe what they had to go through. And so I wonder, when you're using a penal institution to sort of be this social service agency, if you will, what that does to some of the people involved, particularly the most vulnerable, obviously can have very detrimental effects. And I want to play a clip here of an interview that you did, one of the women that you followed, Maria, where she talks about sort of the anxiety that she felt leaving prison and how it was difficult for her to establish even a simple routine. And we will say Maria's not a real name. You did change the names of the participants in the book to protect their privacy. But I want to listen to a little bit of how Maria describes what she had to do to establish a routine after she was released from prison. Let's listen.
The first 6 months, like, I wouldn't eat. Not that I wouldn't eat, but, like, I was so used to, like, you know, somebody telling me, like, when I had to go eat. Do you know what I mean? That, like, like I wouldn't eat until, like, 6 o'clock at night because, like, I didn't have somebody telling me to eat breakfast and eat lunch and eat dinner. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I would go all day without eating and then just come home and eat dinner.
So, Bruce Western, in the book you use the term prisonization and deprisonization. Is this what you're talking about here? Sort of people who were prisonized, if you will, and how they have to then make that transition. Explain what that does to someone and how it affects reentry.
Yeah. So there was this old term, prisonization, that sociologist Donald Clemmer coined in the 1940s, and he described this as all the little behavioral adaptations that people made to being incarcerated. And we saw in our reentry study, as people returned to community, they had to shed all of these little behaviors and become used to life in free society. So, for example, a lot of people we were speaking to, particularly in the first couple of weeks after they got out of prison, they were very anxious in crowds. They avoided riding the T. They avoided riding the bus. They didn't like being jostled at all. People wouldn't apologize to them if they bumped into them on the street. Mm. And this was a whole new mode of social interaction that the people we're interviewing had to adapt to. After people came out, they got haircuts. They bought new clothes. They had welcome home parties. And these were all little steps on the way to shedding the institution, leaving it behind, and trying to find a place back in society again. And this is a process of deprisonization. And Maria's experience, I think, was really typical. Things, normal things that we have to do to just take part in everyday life, she had to relearn again after incarceration.
In the last minute or so that we have left, Bruce Western, I'm wondering if you could tell me, what did you find surprising about this? I think many of us might think, you know, a lot of people are suffering. A lot of people in jail probably do have mental illness and substance use disorders, and probably violence is an issue and poverty is an issue. What stood out most to you?
Yeah, I think one of the things that was really unexpected for us, and we sort of learned it slowly as we got to know the people we were talking to, and that was the great exposure to violence and trauma over a lifetime that people in state prison were facing. And I think, you know, in criminal justice policy talk, it divides the world into two groups of people, victims and offenders. You're either one or the other, and the system keeps potential victims safe from offenders. But all the people we were talking to were both victims and offenders. They had significant histories of victimization that often began very early in childhood. And I, for me, this was tremendously ethically challenging. I think we should be rethinking our foundations of our penal institutions.
All right. Bruce Western, sociology professor at Harvard University, visiting professor at Columbia University, and author of Homeward, Life in the Year After Prison. Bruce, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you very much.
Stay with us. Coming up, the music of Alanis Morissette on stage at the ART. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker.
I'm broke, but I'm happy. I'm poor, but I'm kind. I'm short, but I'm healthy, yeah. I'm high, but I'm grounded.
Alanis Morissette's 1995 album, Jagged Little Pill, is the inspiration for and the name of a new musical now having its world premiere at the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge. The musical, Jagged Little Pill, combines Morissette's emotionally sharp lyrics with the story of a Connecticut family struggling with many of the issues and the ills of 2018. When we met with Diane Paulus, the ART's artistic director, last week, we started by asking her about the idea of blending Morissette's music into a theatrical production.
I'm always interested in making works of theater that speak to the culture at large. So Jagged Little Pill was a cultural moment in America in the 90s, and it had such significance and resonance for a whole generation of listeners. Alanis's bold, raw emotional release of rage and empowerment, I think was a watershed moment, especially for women in music. So I wanted to bring that power from the album and give it a theatrical life. And for me, that meant releasing the album into a story that could hold that visceral power through theater.
But it's interesting that that music from 1995 speaks to this cultural moment, then? Is that what you're saying? So well, are you kind of saying, hey, we didn't really get anywhere since then? Or look at how these issues still continue to resonate? Or what is it?
I was overwhelmed by how much of that album, Jagged Little Pill from the 90s, felt like it was written yesterday for what we're going through in America today. And I think it has to do with the fact that Alanis was unafraid 20-some years ago to give voice to certain issues that now as a country we're in crisis with, that we have to face. So themes of waking up, of being unafraid to look at the mess within us, the themes of numbing ourselves just to get through life, and also sexual trauma. These are all things that Alanis had her finger on the pulse of, and she did it through her unbelievable poetry of her lyrics. But now it's a time for us to want to be, and frankly, we need to be in the presence of these themes. And that's what I'm feeling with this piece as a piece of theater, and seeing how audiences are responding to it, seeing how people are feeling, yes, all these things are happening and it's bubbling over. And somehow Alanis's music, which was so powerful then, feels necessary in a way that is really uncanny for our times.
And you actually use direct imagery of things happening now, mm-hmm. imagery from some of the protests. Mm-hmm. Explain why you decided to incorporate that into this. Is that to show that this is still a very important topical issue right now?
We decided to make an original story. We found Diablo Cody, who came on board and unlocked this original story about an American family. And I think here's the deal. You write about an American family living in 2018 America, and they're dealing with all the issues that we are dealing with as Americans right now. Diablo Cody was really interested early on in saying that she felt that this family structure of this musical was almost a microcosm of old America, new America, how parents contain sort of the old America, old values, and how terrified we are of change that is happening, change that is real, change that we cannot deny. And then you've got the younger generation, the kids in the show, that are saying, it's here, I feel it. You know, so when I looked at the lyrics of All I Really Want, one of Alanis's hits, and she says, you know, all I really want is peace, is justice, is a common ground.
And all I really want is some patience.
You know, this is not just about outrage. This is actually about trying to reach across difference and say, how do we coexist in this moment in America where things are changing and things need to break open and we need to wake up?
We should say this is a Connecticut family, white upper middle class Connecticut family. Would you describe them that way? Okay. And there's a veneer too, right? That they are trying to say that they are this perfect family and everything is going well. And at the beginning, Mary Jane Healy, played by Elizabeth Stanley, sits down to write the annual Christmas letter that some families write.
It's been an interesting year. I recovered from my little fender bender in February. My car may have been totaled, but you can't total Mary Jane Healy. After a couple of surgeries, my body is stronger than ever.
I see right through you.
How did I do it? I turned to natural healing solutions. Pilates, acupuncture, and anti-inflammatory foods like miso and blueberries.
I know right through you.
I wonder why you decided to include that in the musical as well.
One of the themes in Alanis's music is the pressure of having to appear a certain way and how that is counter to what is really going on inside, and how do we come to terms with the truth inside of ourselves. And Diablo Cody, our writer, really zoomed in on that and said it is actually terrifying to look inside, and it is the most courageous thing to kind of rip that all away. And at the same time, how hard we work to keep up the appearance that everything is just fine. And so one of Alanis's songs, I See Right Through You, resonated to me when I heard Diablo talking about these themes. You know, I see right through you. I walk right through you. I feel right through you. And the first idea Diablo pitched to me was, what if we started our show with a mother and she's doing everything she can to hold on to the perfection of what she feels she needs to project about her life, about her family, about the success of her children. And yet everything is metaphorically burning around her. And yet what do we do as human beings to hold on to that veneer? And I think Alanis and Diablo and myself, we're all moms. We're not, you know, young teenagers anymore. We're all looking at this music through motherhood and through being women in our 40s and 50s and thinking, well, you know, how do we look at our lives now at this moment and look at our children and dare to see each other. I mean, this is a musical really about, can we see each other? And you can't really see each other if you're too busy putting up the walls and all the protection around you.
When you talk about parents and children here, I think maybe a lot of what we're seeing now is this sort of generational divide, that these young people, what they're rebelling against in a lot of ways is the hypocrisy of their parents. Exactly. And sometimes people of parents' age may have gone along with some of that hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. So are you saying here that, you know, this is a time of reckoning for all of us, and that's where you're trying to find maybe a middle ground in these generations through this story and through the music?
This is definitely a moment of reckoning, and I think we all feel that as we live every day of our life right now in America, as how do we exist? How do we make sense of the trauma that can no longer be hidden that goes on in our country? And this is an opportunity with this musical to address that very particularly through the microcosm of a family.
You've obviously thought a lot about this. So when you think about Me Too as a movement right now in this play, as a symbol of what's happening culturally, how would you describe it? Like where it is right now? You know, will there be backlash? You know, are we starting to see that now? I mean, when you think about that, what would you say?
I think we are at a moment where women are being believed. And as a country, we're all becoming aware of secrets and past trauma. And we're also becoming aware of the complicity that we all play in this. And I think that's another theme in our musical, is that the more we become aware of how all these issues touch us and the complicity, whether it's, you know, a parent who owns a gun that a kid gets a hold of, you know, that we're all looking as we open up the paper on a daily basis and wonder how are these things happening, and seeing how there's systems of complicity. All of that is starting to shift. And I think we are at such a powerful moment. It's scary. And I think that's what Jagged Little Pill says. It's not going to be easy. It's a jagged little pill. It's a pill that's going to hurt and it's going to kind of scrape as you swallow it. And Alanis always says, you know, her songs go dark, but within the darkness is the hope. It's like if you can dare to go to that place, you will then see the light at the end of the tunnel. And, you know, that's what I appreciate about her music. You know, the song You Live, You Learn is such at the core of everything this musical stands for. And that's why I do the theater, right, is to go through all these experiences and actually learn from them and to be able to share them and transmit some kind of transformation to an audience. That's the microcosm of the theater, which is really, you know, what that song is all about and what we hope to do with a show like Jagged Little Pill. Swallow it down.
Ann Paulus is artistic director at the ART. She led the production of Jagged Little Pill. It'll be at the ART in Cambridge through July 15th. More information is at our website, radioboston.org. That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.